Thank you. I should say, Steve, that you should know that Roger took umbrage at that Andor crack, rightly perceiving to whom it was directed. The task assigned the panel is to answer the question, is there still a Constitution? If the question is taken literally, the answer is yes. I saw it myself some years ago, lying peacefully there in the archives. And I have little reason to doubt it's still there. If the question is whether the Constitution is still the basis of our system of government, the answer is that to a large extent it still is. We still have a bicameral legislature, a president elected for four-year terms, and so on. Indeed, we still have a Senate with two members from each state, giving Wyoming the same political importance in the Senate as California, despite the fact that California has 60 times as many people. The persistence of an arrangement that irrational would be difficult to explain, except by continued adherence to an outmoded and difficult to change constitution. The real point of the question, however, I take it, is to ask whether the Constitution is still the basis and source of our court's constitutional decisions. The answer to this question is that it is doubtful that the Constitution was ever the real basis and source of the judicial constitutional decisions, not just since the New Deal, the last 40 years. And it most certainly has not been the basis for these decisions for the last 40 years. The sad truth and the source of many of our most serious contemporary problems is that the Constitution today has almost nothing to do with constitutional law. That last statement may seem shocking, or surely at least exaggerated, but I assure you that it is not, as can be easily shown, indeed scientifically demonstrated. It should be recognized, first of all, that the Constitution is a very short and apparently straightforward document, easily printed with all amendments, repealers, and obsolete matter in 13 or 14 pages. It is not the fat volume that is often depicted in political cartoons. It is nothing at all like the Talmud, the Bible, or even the tax code, vast and mysterious works in which almost anything can be found with sufficient search. Second, the vast bulk of constitutional decision-making, at least rulings of unconstitutionality, involves state, not federal law. There are 50 state legislatures and only one, thank goodness, Congress. And the Supreme Court is much more comfortable and assured in reducing the political power of the states than in reducing the political power of the government of which it is a part. Nearly all invalidations, so virtually all constitutional state law, well over 95%, and nearly all invalidations of state law purport to be based on a single constitutional provision, the 14th Amendment. Indeed, on a single sentence of that amendment, and ultimately on four words, due process and equal protection. It does not require a high degree of jurisprudential sophistication to understand that Supreme Court justices do not reach their decisions on a vast array of difficult social problems by studying those four words. That's all that's involved. You really don't have to know much more than that to know it's not the Constitution. It is conventional to state that disagreements in constitutional law arise out of different understandings of the Constitution resulting from different methods of interpretation. In fact, however, no question of interpretation is involved in any of the Supreme Court's controversial constitutional decisions of the past four decades. These decisions do not turn on the justices' understanding of constitutional language. They turn solely on the justices' policy preferences and their willingness to use their office to substitute these preferences for the preferences that prevailed in the ordinary political process. The irrelevance of the Constitution to constitutional law, as I say, should be evident enough from the fact that so little is even purportedly being interpreted, is easy to illustrate by actual decisions. For example, there was once a time when the Constitution permitted the assignment of children to public schools on the basis of race. We know this, as we know everything about the Constitution, because the court told us so in Plessy v. Ferguson in 1896. There then came a time when the Constitution prohibited the assignment of children to school on the basis of race, as the court told us in Brown v. Board of Education in 1954. Finally, there came a time, the present, when the Constitution requires the assignment of children to school on the basis of race, as the court held in Swan v. Charlotte Mecklenburg in 1971, the first busing case. That covers all the possibilities, permitted, prohibited, required. Yet in all that time, the Constitution was not changed in any relevant respect. All that changed was the identity of the judges making the decisions. A scientific observer would have little difficulty concluding that the Constitution is not the relevant variable. To take another example from the same area of law, in Brown, as everyone knows, the court held that school racial segregation is unconstitutional. The reason, as everyone also knows, or thinks he knows, is that it was found to be prohibited by the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. Everything's either equal protection or due process, as I say. Now, wouldn't it be wonderful if it were possible to test that belief or hypothesis scientifically? The difference between social science and real science, of course, is that science makes testable predictions, while social science is largely a matter of ideologically motivated assertions. If a scientist hypothesized, for example, that it is the presence of chemical X that causes a certain liquid to turn blue, but finds that it turns blue in the absence of chemical X, he would consider the hypothesis refuted. What if it were possible to run the Brown case again, but this time without the Equal Protection Clause, just to see what difference its absence would make? Well, as if to aid the cause of scientific investigation, this is exactly what happened. On the same day that the court decided Brown, involving state segregation laws, it also decided Bowling v. Sharp, involving segregation in the District of Columbia, where it was required by federal law. By its terms, the 14th Amendment applies only to the states, and the Constitution has no equal protection clause applicable to the federal government. There was no chemical X. What difference did that make in the result the court reached? None at all. Segregation was equally unconstitutional in the District of Columbia. The liquid still turned blue. It is unconstitutional this time, the court said, because it violates the Due Process Clause of the Fifth Amendment, which does apply to the federal government. That is, we ought to understand, a provision added to the Constitution in 1791 to a Constitution explicitly recognizing slavery is to be understood as prohibiting school segregation. If the Due Process Clause were unavailable, the court no doubt would have found that segregation in District of Columbia violates the constitutional prohibition of discrimination against seaports. It would have done at least as well. To take another example, famous to you, in the 1973 Roe v. Wade decision, the court discovered in the Due Process Clause, again, of the 14th Amendment, a constitutional right to abortion on demand. The Due Process Clause was then 105 years old, and all 50 states had laws restricting abortion. Can it be that no one had noticed that the 14th Amendment prohibits restrictions on abortion until Harry Blackmun came along and pointed it out? But which part of the Due Process Clause, I've always wondered, prohibits restrictions on abortion? Is it due or is it process? Because that's all there is. You have to take your choice. Restrictions on abortion became unconstitutional, of course, not because of anything in the Constitution, but again, only because a majority of the justices, serving as usual as the mirror, mouthpiece, and enacting arm of the academic left, favored a policy of unrestricted abortion and were willing to impose that preferred policy on the people of the states. All that's involved. justices of the Supreme Court are not only willing to find in the Constitution what is not there, but also to act in defiance of what is there. This is illustrated by the insistence of Justices Brennan, Marshall, and Blackmun that capital punishment is unconstitutional, despite the fact that the Constitution recognizes capital punishment in several places. Now, what's that got to do with it being unconstitutional? The answer to the question, then, is there still a Constitution, is that there is, but that it has almost nothing to do with contemporary constitutional law. A Constitution, like any law or written communication, can be effective only if it is read in good faith, in an honest effort to determine the intention of its authors or ratifiers. Good faith is not generally to be found, however, as Lord Acton's dictum tells us, among possessors of unreviewable power, such as the justices of the Supreme Court. Good faith would place limitations on power. The result is that the system of government created by the Constitution, based on the twin principles of federalism and republicanism, has degenerated into a system of government by judges, totally centralized and totally undemocratic. We have somehow arrived at a system of government by lawyers in robes, unelected and holding office for life, deciding basic issues of social policy, literally often of life and death, as in abortion, capital punishment, for the nation as a whole, under the guise of interpreting the Constitution. A more irrational and dangerous system of government would be difficult to imagine, and its results have been what is to be expected. It has given us a system of criminal justice, for example, known to no other system of law, making the enforcement of the criminal law so difficult, complex, and expensive, as Steve Markman pointed out this morning, as often to seem not worthwhile even trying to enforce it. It has barred the states from imposing effective restrictions on the publication and distribution of pornographic materials. It has disabled the states from imposing effective controls on public vagrancy. It has ordered that public school children be barred from the neighborhood schools and bused to distant schools in an attempt to create school racial balance, even though the predictable effect has been to drive the middle class from the urban public school systems, devastating both those school systems and the cities themselves. The list of the pernicious effects of this new system of government for the nation as a whole by judges in Washington is a long one, but this should be enough, I think, to show that it is not an improvement on the system of decentralized government by elected representatives that was created by the Constitution. Thank you.